From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Unionized Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and games development. I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are role-playing and to rebuild or not to rebuild. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start!
And...
I am Joanna. I'm here as a guest.
You're not gonna say the line.
Starting strong.
Wait. There's a line. I don't have a laptop in front of me.
Do you make these games?
You were here 15 seconds ago, right? Hey, everybody! Joanna's back in the clubhouse.
Yes.
Yay.
Joanna May, our pal and previous guest, has joined us.
She makes nice games.
She does make nice games. She's making one now.
I make nice game tools. It's different.
Ah, okay.
Joanna's here for the next 2 weeks, which is going to be really fun. Thank you for joining us, Joanna.
Thank you. I'm thrilled that I get to hang out in your office for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yes, that's how it works.
That is how it works.
All right. Well, to little frivolity up top, Steven, you got news.
I beat Blueprints.
Yeah.
Nice.
Beat. Ain't nothing left.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was grueling. But also, honestly, the last part.
Would you say at all worth your time?
I mean, how much is video games actually worth your time in all seriousness?
I'm just going to say we could be flippant about that, but our job as artists is to make it worth people's time.
You're right. Yeah. It's true. I did enjoy my time with Blueprints.
Yeah.
The end part was a slog.
Mm-hmm.
But like the little bit before it was nice, before the actual very end. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to talk about without spoiling things.
Yeah.
Which is the problem with Blueprint.
It's tough with that game, too, because like when a movie comes out and then a couple months have passed, you're like, well, if people weren't that interested to see it by now, then it's fine to spoil. It's okay. You know?
Yeah.
But with a video game, like, because they take so long,
yeah,
people who are like really into it, but then just had to jump off and like were going to get back to it, like, mm-hmm. it's still the window for them.
Yeah.
Even though it's been months and months.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know. But I will say, like, because I bounce off of it, like, there's like this sort of that room full of like fancy doors, this sort of post game part.
Mm.
There's like seven of those.
Mm.
Does the game go on well past that?
Yes, you picked a good ending place.
Yeah.
If you wanted to stop playing. Yeah, that's kind
of. But you had the motivation, you powered through, and was it interesting challenges, like variations or new things?
Yeah, new stuff.
Yeah.
Fun things. I think it is worth people's time. I got a lot of hints, otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to get through it. So, but like, you know, it's very fun.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I still would recommend Blueprint.
Yeah.
It's still worth it. I think it's still great. Mark, you also completed a game recently.
I rolled credits on DK Bonanza.
Let's go.
Which we'll never call it Donkey Kong Bonanza. It's DK Bonanza.
Okay.
Called it that.
Okay, well. All right, you got me. But the entire game.
Nobody like, calls him Donkey Kong.
Everyone's just like, DK, DK.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Pauline's like, just charming, DK. I love it. And so, yeah, DK Bonanza.
Yeah.
It has a couple of false endings as well to warn people. I think people should know that because it did set my motivation.
Oh.
Because it was like toward the end of like a play session. And I was like, oh, okay, this is great. I'll like do this thing and then it'll be done. Or maybe it'll be like a second boss level thing after this or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it was like the first of like three or four false endings. And I was like, all right, I'll just keep going, I guess. And that was kind of disappointing to me. It was very much the games are too long. And then there's lots of post-game content, which I have not started yet.
Yeah.
Or rather, I have just started that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm actually kind of excited to do that later.
Mm.
So that's great. But I was kind of disappointed. Do you think we can do spoilers for DK Bonanza?
I don't think we should, because it's only been out for a month.
Yeah.
So.
But
Don't spoil it. I nearly bought it the other night, but then I was like, not tonight.
Yeah.
But it's the one with the destructible terrain, right?
Yes. Oh, you would like it so much.
That is quite a lot of fun. Yeah.
And like, it's like, yeah, of course you call that game Bonanza. Like, that's the most unhinged game. Like, I was watching their 20-minute trailer, and like every few seconds they were like, oh yeah, and by the way, there's this feature, and oh, there's also this. It's like, what did they work on this for, like a decade or something?
Yeah.
Yes, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh wow. Okay. It's like, wow, they're just showing off. Wow, they're really showing off.
Yeah.
And they just like kept stacking on these amazing features, and I was like, wow. Nobody's done it this well.
Mm-hmm.
So two thoughts about that. One is I really like how casually you can break everything.
Yeah.
Once you upgrade all your abilities, just like walking along a path, suddenly you'll just graze something and it'll just fall apart.
Yeah.
And you're like, none of this matters. Like, you know what I mean? You quickly lose the preciousness of your own user pathing. You just kind of like come what may. But the frustrating part was, as I got toward the end of the game, I'm like, oh, this requires more precision platforming, more like combination of the different mechanics that they've added. And it's all very sloppy. Like, it's a very rewarding, fun game that's not a precision platformer, right?
Right.
But then suddenly when I need to, like, precision throw a thing or jump from this platform to that, or I need to, like, go straight up as the snake in, like, 10 seconds, it's suddenly the camera moves too slow, the button, the controls aren't as responsive as I'd like.
Yeah.
Certain things are too forgiving in a way that makes things happen when you don't intend them to.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're not supposed to make it that far.
Well, and all of that is to the game's benefit for the majority of it.
Yeah.
But as soon as it starts doing like what I would call Mario gameplay, where Odyssey did a much better job of this,
because it's
a more traditional platformer.
Yeah.
This game tried to do a lot of that, and it was kind of frustrating.
Oh, I see.
And then I started trying. I ended up cheesing my way around a bunch of challenges because the game is also lets you beat things in many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I'm like, oh, I know it wants me to do the zebra here, but the zebra's no fun.
Truly,
and no, it wants me to do the snake here, but never again.
Yeah.
And so, like, I would just find another way around it. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, I guess I didn't enjoy the fun they wanted out of this. And that's also true in the boss battles where it expects you to like combine a couple things,
yeah,
which is a great idea, but to change the bonanza powers you need to like use the D-pad to go left and right,
yeah,
and it's just not quite
is
responsive.
It called that bonanza powers,
yeah, it's powered by bananergy.
Oh this keeps getting better.
I know, right?
All
right,
no more spoilers.
And that's the thing about, like, I love every tonally, it's like one of the best games I've ever played. Like it really, all of that stuff, it's very much it all lines up really well.
Yeah.
But mechanically, I started to see the seams, and that it started to become a little bit, you know, and there was very obviously late in the game, like, oh, there's a bonanza they didn't finish in the feast layer, if you know what I'm talking about.
I don't.
Okay.
But okay.
But there's
so, like, a game developer started seeing flaws.
I know,
in
right?
Game.
Wow. Never happened before.
Right.
But I guess because I love Mario games and this is made by one of the Mario teams.
Yeah.
I think it was like, oh, actually, they should have gone against those instincts because it ended up making the game a little bit, it fell apart a little.
Yeah.
Because there was a mismatch, it sounds like.
Yeah.
I agree with that, because that was kind of the issue I was having when I played through it too.
Mm-hmm. I love the puzzly discover searching. That's the gameplay that you're like trying to, like, where would that be? And how am I to get there? Mm-hmm. But the actual, like, press the button to reach this platform, it got less and less fun.
Sure.
That part of it.
Yeah, that's fair.
But there's a whole bunch more content for me, so I'm looking forward to that. But
hopefully
like
less.
But like not now. Like,
yeah. take a break
for a while, yeah.
You said something earlier, and just being like really serious and talking about like the purpose of game developers as artists is to make it worth people's time. And I was thinking this whole time that it was like to make a lot of money doing knockoffs like Pow World.
No, you don't make a lot of money doing that unless you already have a lot of money up front. So.
I mean, different, you know, different structure, different folks, I guess.
I suppose.
Yeah.
It's about asset flips, right?
Yeah.
Lydia, you've beaten the game as well.
Yeah, I also rolled credits on Dave the Diver.
Let's go.
Ooh. Yay.
That's also a very long game. We've been, done a lot of gaming.
Oh, I don't actually know how long it was, because
I just know it has a lot of stuff in it.
It does have a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
I haven't exactly been keeping track in terms of how many hours. But yeah, I had dropped off for a month when I hit the point where it's like, oh, okay, I think final boss is going to be here. I need to make sure that I have enough oxygen and the other upgrades and such. And then I finally went back to it and I did the thing and I rolled credits and it was awesome.
Nice.
Yay. I enjoyed it very much. I don't know if I will go back because you can keep playing.
Is there also post-game content kind of stuff?
No, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like you can find all the fish, you can upgrade, you can keep running your sushi bar as long as you want.
As a roguelike, it's also just like meant to be kind of pastimey, right? Like,
it's not really a roguelike.
Oh, it's not?
No, that was the thing is I had been told it was, but it really kind of isn't.
Okay.
Mm. I would say it's more, I mean, it's more akin to like when you go into the mines in Stardew Valley, the mines are a little bit, the layout of each mine floor is a little bit different, but it basically follows the structure of like you go this deep, it has this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then it's like what you find in the mines are in service of, you know, what you have plans for on your farm. It's a lot more akin to that, which I don't actually, in at least for me, like, I don't think of that as being a roguelike, really.
Sure.
And it's also not the type, if it is a roguelike, it's not the type of roguelike that I, it's not the type of thing that I would, like, play before bed to help me fall asleep. That's more like Balatro, Slay the Spire, Peglin.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. But yeah, so I don't really know if I'll return back to it, but I really enjoyed playing it a lot. Oh. It was consistently just like surprising, and I was like, "Whoa, wait! They suddenly we're at an idol concert doing a rhythm game. Suddenly we're like in a, from her perspective, kind of visual novel-y. Oh, there's this pop person who's here, and I'm helping her. I think I've heard this song on TikTok. What? Suddenly Balatro? What?
Oh wow, okay.
It was just, I really enjoyed it. I found it quite charming. It was hard in ways that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And it was also just kind of nice to get to be able to do it in your own rhythm. Like I can imagine someone just wanting to speedrun the narrative part and not actually want to engage with much of the exploration and the fishes and the sushi and that kind of little side management thing. But I like that it doesn't pressure you to do it any one way.
Yeah.
You know, they're linked. Like, you need money to buy stuff to be able to go deeper in the water.
Right.
But it's not saying like you have to get this done within a certain number of days, or it's not saying you have to, you know, I don't know. I enjoyed it because it was one of those games. It successfully was one of those games where you could kind of choose how you wanted to play at any given moment. And some days you just want to do narrative, and some days you just want to explore and make sushi, and it's totally okay.
Yeah.
And that's nice.
That is one of the things that's nice about like having a big game like that, that gives you a lot of options, is you can approach it in different ways on different days, depending on your feel.
Yeah.
So it sounds like Dave the Diver gave you that permission, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Enjoyed it.
Cool. Yeah, cool.
Okay, Steve, before we get into your topic.
Uh-huh.
I do have a question for you.
Yes.
That I promised I would ask.
Oh no.
How is
Dale your reminded you to ask me?
No, I put it on the my calendar.
No. That's even worse.
Remember to ask Steven how his fishing minigame prototypes are doing.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
How's that going? You only have like two or three probably. Like I'm not you know, not pressure to have a lot.
Yeah, sure. No. Okay, so Mark did fulfill his end of the bargain, and he did give me a play date to play. And so I've been mostly doing that.
yeah, there's too many games on that.
He's in the research phase.
Yeah, right.
Which, if you recall, he said he didn't want to do too much of.
Mm-hmm, yep. So it ends today. No, I haven't gotten any. I did download the thing that lets you like make playdate games. But I haven't like actually done any development work yet.
So. Well, I mean, you know, I think in that episode we talked about there was many ways you could get started.
Right.
Like if you want to, just dive in that environment. But, you know, there's always the paper prototype angle and just the note-taking stuff. But you haven't gotten started.
That's what I actually need to do is a paper prototype. That'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's figured it out. Thanks.
Okay.
Sometimes you need a rubber duck. Mm-hmm. So I will do that.
All right. I'll set another reminder.
I set it on air. Now I've committed.
But what else have you been
doing? You set it on air 2 weeks ago.
I know. Like,
you're fine.
Yes.
But I will not stop bugging you.
Okay.
So that you and the listeners are aware.
That's good, because that means I have to do something. Otherwise, I'm going to get annoyed. All right, I have a topic.
Quickly, swiftly moving on.
My topic is role-playing.
Yeah.
So I've been playing D&D recently. I've been gushing about it with Lydia, which has been fun. And I've also been playing Baldur's Gate. We're on our sixth playthrough of that game now.
Oh, hot damn.
It's actually ridiculous. And the game is not small, so... It's just fun playing it co-op. Mm-hmm. But I'm playing a bunch of different characters that are quite different from myself. In the D&D campaign that we're playing, mm-hmm. I'm playing like a bookish orc. And she really wants to be like academic and go to and be like a professor, like learn about magic. She's a thief, which mm-hmm. is kind of weird. But she wants to learn about magic. And then in Baldur's Gate, I'm playing as one of the main characters that you, the default characters come in. I'm playing as Lazelle.
Nice.
The, Gith Yankee warrior,
mm-hmm.
playing her as a monk. And it's been interesting to like role play as these different characters. And I wanted to talk about a little bit of my experience with that and maybe everybody else's experience with role playing in games. Because I think that oftentimes when you go into a game, you are kind of embodying that character. Like when you're playing DK Bonanza,
uh-huh.
you are embodying DK and you're punching a bunch of stuff. even though DK doesn't really punch stuff in most of the games, it doesn't actually matter. in this game...
Because of how much he punches stuff in this game.
Yes, actually true.
He now punches stuff.
Yeah, he now punches stuff. But, like, you're embodying that. And so, like, you just punch a bunch of things, and that's your solution to all of your problems. In other games, you also role-play in that kind of avenue, but there's also role-playing in that, like, you are... You create a character, like in like an Elder Scrolls game or something like that. You create a character and you decide to make decisions based off of what you feel like that character would do. So I guess I wanted to talk about what role playing is, what and what that maybe means, and like how to make a game that can invite the player to do some kind of role playing.
Yeah.
I guess, are we going to talk simultaneously or separately about
all at once? We all talk at once.
Probably
we already do that. Talking about role playing at a table,
yeah,
in a kind of TTRPG setting where or a LARPing setting where, you know, I, Lydia, I'm here talking to you and we are able to have just that flexibility, or are we talking or are we going to be talking about in video games where, you know, there are the parameters of the computer systems and the game systems?
I suspect all of the above.
But I guess I want to talk about, or I guess I want to ask, are we talking about those simultaneously, or are we going to talk about one first then the other? Because they are very different just by the nature of the medium.
That's true. I guess I was thinking of it more in terms of video games. But I think that, like, role-playing in a tabletop RPG feels different in that, like, people approach it in different ways. Like, some people will really get into character and, like, do an accent and, like, you know, only speak within that as that character. When I play, it's kind of weird because I'm like both the character and me at the same time.
Yeah.
But I just talk as myself.
That's pretty common.
Yeah, I think
so. A lot of times, you know, either and it's, player styles are different,
or
DMs will sometimes impose or suggest that, like, when you're doing player actions, role plays your character. But a lot of times people are just like, they just narrate third person what their character does.
Yeah.
And they don't worry about the performance of it.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of a burden on people sometimes.
And that is a totally valid way to play.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
Yeah.
But either way, that embodiment is what you're really talking about.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah. So I guess it's that sensation, if that answers your question. It's not necessarily the, like, getting into, like, acting part of it. It's more of the just, like,
How do you make decisions? If this is about interesting decisions, getting in the headspace to make interesting decisions that your character would make.
Yes, and how do you as a developer create a game that gives the player that permission to do that kind of thing?
Maybe we go around the table and talk a little bit about our experiences as the player real quickly, and then focus as much as we can on the developer side of it.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a very rich topic available to us talking about playing and embodying characters, but maybe that's a topic for another time.
And to be fair, that is a little bit game development, right?
Yeah.
Like, you are embodying a character and you're creating a world as you're doing it, and that's part of play. But yeah, I'm talking about it from a developer's perspective, or at least I'm trying to. So yeah, that makes sense. Mark, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. I mean, sometimes I feel different from other people on this because in video games and in role-playing games, I feel like an author or a narrator. I don't really embody a character. I write them.
Sure.
That's how I feel. That's the metaphor I use.
Okay.
In practice, it doesn't really seem different. But when I hear people talk about, like, embodying a character, like okay, sure, but, like, it's more interesting to me to think of from a third person perspective.
Sure.
And I'm the narrator, I guess. I don't. Maybe that's just a matter of semantics.
No, I
especially in video games, like when you're talking about Donkey Kong. Like, you know, DK. sorry, I just mispronounced his name.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't feel like the character.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a marionette for me to...
Okay.
I'm the puppeteer.
Yeah.
That's how I always feel that way with characters that have defined characteristics. If I'm the one who creating the character, I feel similarly, but also I feel more like an author than I do an actor.
It sounds more like you're embodying not from first person perspective, but from close third perspective.
Yeah, okay. That's a good way of framing it. I kind of agree with that's kind of how I approach it too a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So
I sometimes am interested to know, is that really a difference or is it just a perspective? Anyway, that's me.
Okay. I talked about mine a little bit already. Lydia, do you want to go?
Yeah. I don't know if I actually embody. I'm not very good at acting. I'm a little bit more good at improving bits.
And that's good for a podcast.
Yeah.
Listeners will already know.
Yeah.
But I think I like to think about I don't really know how to answer this. Mm-hmm. I guess I don't know how to answer it in a meta way. I'm going to talk about it just what am I doing in D&D right now.
Yeah, okay.
I am currently playing a character named Henley who I come up with years ago. So, and I told Ian this idea for a character and they said, hey, can I reserve you to play this character for the campaign I'm designing? I was like, yeah, sure.
Oh.
So I was thinking it would be very interesting to have a character who is illiterate and knows only signed thieves' cant and spoken common language, trying to find someone via text. And then I realized, ah, damn it, I'm a person who talks a lot and I made someone who is severely hampered with language because only knows signed thieves' cant. Doesn't know spoken or read thieves' cant either, but only signed because they lived in silence with all the monks.
Yeah.
And spoken common. And so I had to kind of think of, I essentially tried to create little, like, rules for myself. The main one being is that I decided the way that I was going to try and get into how to engage with the world as Henley is that Henley does not ask questions that she does not want the answer to.
Sure.
So I kind of created like a rule to follow, and then other little things followed from that.
Yeah.
Character-wise, like they accidentally trauma dump sometimes, yeah. And then wind back. The pragmatism of like one problem at a time, like go into contractor mode, fold arms, and go like, oh, the joinery's really nice, huh? You know, that sort of thing following through. But I needed a rule to start off with that would be the guiding rule when presented with a difficult decision that Lydia would want to take over.
That's a framework that I think works well for me, and I think maybe works well for other players, is like designing a set of rules that players have to follow to get benefits, or not necessarily have to follow, but they get rewarded for following. Like you got rewarded by interesting story bits, and other. You could get rewarded by getting strength points. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But like the point is, if you have a framework where these are rules that your character is supposed to follow or wants to follow, or is encouraged to follow, you can follow that up game design wise by actually benefiting them in some way, shape, or
form. Yeah. I will say one thing that I find what I like about and what I don't like in games is when there is only one option.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that's kind of a bummer sometimes about and you get this also with like, you know, if you play dating sims or whatever, where it's like, oh, you have to answer the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, if Lazelle would only answer this way, otherwise it doesn't seem like she's Lazelle.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily like that.
Sure. Because
it's like, oh, there's only one way that this it's not as interesting or as dimensional, I guess.
Yeah.
What I prefer a little bit more is something like how they do it in Horizon Zero Dawn, where you have three ways as Aloy to respond to any given situation, and they are very much Aloy, but is her particular response in this moment channeling her intelligence, her compassion, or her strength?
Yeah,
those are all integral parts of Aloy as a person. It's just which well does she pull from?
Right.
And I think that for me, I needed to start with one rule to figure out one of those wells for Henley. And then as I started playing, I found more wells to pull from.
Yeah.
That as Henley, at any given moment now, I can go, how do I want to respond? And it's not a right answer binary.
You got to be allowed to create a three-dimensional character as opposed to two-dimensional characters. And rules allow you to make two-dimensional characters, but like there needs to be granularity and variance in that to make it more depth.
Yeah.
To give it more depth, yeah. Joanna. I've not asked you this question yet. How do you role play?
Oh gosh, I'm the worst person to ask.
Oh no,
I don't think I have an imagination.
That seems false.
I
don't know that I'm thinking. I might just be like feeling. I'd be like, oh, this is very satisfying. Dopamine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's also, I think, in contrast to Lydia, the sort of like the deep thought you put into the sort of like character motivations. In contrast, it sounds like that's what you would need to have, like, or at least up on that path. But like, the role of the designer is to let the player do it naturally.
Yeah,
to feel it. Right. It's like D&D is a whole nother ball game. Right?
Yeah, no, that's true.
Like, it requires more of players. But even systems like that, in my opinion, anyway, should be designed to not demand players be really active in that sense, in order for them to claim to their friends that they experienced, had a role play experience.
Yeah, yeah. So DK Bonanza, right? You're playing as DK and you're punching a bunch of stuff. You're not like, you can role play as though you are DK, but
so
ultimately.
So in that context, Joanna, like video games broadly.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Wait, do you consider just playing any video game role playing?
Well, I guess that's kind of the heart of Steven's question, right?
Something like, I don't know. I think a good example is like Untitled Goose Game. You are handed the key to be a little annoying chaos gremlin. Do you, when you play those sorts of, like, are there games where, you know, they essentially give you the invitation to be a menace and you wholeheartedly take that opportunity? Because I feel like that is what Mark's kind of talking about.
Yeah, like, you know, there's optimal ways to operate the machine of a video game versus what the tone and world invite you to do in its setting.
Mm-hmm.
And Goose Game's a really good example of that.
Because,
you know, we talked about min-maxing a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
And, like, that is something where you abandon all of that tone and style for, like, numbers play.
Mm.
And that's, people have different, you know, modes. Some people lean really far towards one, some towards others, some let the game themselves guide them.
Yeah.
So, Joanna, for you, where do you fall in those dimensions?
I guess, well, first of all, you can't min-max if you're not good.
I mean, you can. You're just bad at it, I guess. But okay.
That's just minning.
That's good.
So, like, I can only do that with stuff that I've, like, played a long time. And even then, I'm not that great. But
okay.
I've not ever played D&D, actually. I think I played Cogent, whatever the variant is, a long time ago.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I found I didn't have the patience to pretend that hard in a group for that long.
Sure, okay.
I get distracted easily, I guess.
Well, and the framework didn't work for you.
I suppose not. I think, I don't know, like, and so all my friends play it, so I hear a lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I don't... Like, obviously, I play video games.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know how much I put myself in the shoes or if I'm... I don't know how to explain it, but it's just, like, brain, you know, kind of turns off. And you're just like, oh, I'm supposed to shoot stuff in this game, so I shoot stuff. I'm supposed to explore stuff in this game, so I explore stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't really feel like I'm, you know, that character.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I guess the other part of this, and this is very endemic to video games, and many types of video games have, that's where the silent protagonist is, right?
Yeah.
They impose as little on the player as possible so the player can be themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the role you're playing essentially is that you signed up for what, you know, whatever military shooter you're playing. and it's you in that setting.
Right.
That is a kind of role play, you know, as well.
Yeah, I agree.
And some players prefer that. They don't want a lot of, you know, personal backstory for their own character. They want to be themselves in a game.
Mm-hmm.
Like No Man's Sky is a pretty good example of it, where it's very specifically like the game tells you nothing about you.
Yeah.
It's entirely up to you to decide. And and also no choices you make in that capacity have any impact on the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. It's not like D&D where you're writing a character that interacts. It's just you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's like just like a whole personality type of people who are like, oh, I don't have a desire to be somebody else. I just want to be myself all the time.
I mean, I'm a person who I say that I don't like acting. I do like role playing because I like thinking of what it would be like to be a different person. Never mind. I'm realizing.
I feel like we did a whole episode on this years ago, but like character creation, right?
Yeah.
Do you like invent a character with all the options that are given to you, or do you try to make it look as much like you as possible?
Yeah.
Right. And people have different attitudes to it. Now, after that point, how different is the play experience for those two people?
Right. Like,
maybe not that much.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think it's also like, where do you put that? Because I am sitting here realizing that I love coming up with different character personalities.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I have a problem with in D&D is I have a lot of trouble building really different builds. I joke that I'm very liberal arts with how I stat my characters and that I want to be like a little bit decent in everything, because that's kind of how I am, is okay at a little bit of everything and not particularly good at one thing. And I keep falling into that trap stat-wise or build-wise.
Yeah.
But every time I've made a character, they're very different personality, very different background, very different kind of way that they respond to the world. And that's kind of weird that I fall into those two different traps within ostensibly the same game system.
Yeah. Well, I think it's two different instincts of yours are coming out, right?
Yeah.
Like when it comes to stats, it's very similar to how video games work, where we're like, where you put your skill tree is like, mm-hmm. it's like your play style.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. your play style doesn't necessarily, it can, but it doesn't have to be tied to your sort of like story style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and D&D actually does allow you, particularly, you know, if you have a DM who's very narrative focused, it does allow you to just like, whatever the numbers are, fine. We'll roll some dice, who cares? But it's storytelling. And so like those mm-hmm. systems can be separated and but the motivation as to how you approach one or the other, sometimes they can be really intertwined, and I imagine that's very satisfying when they are, but they also don't really have to be. So like I wouldn't describe what you're saying as a problem necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like if you're still enjoying yourself.
Oh, yeah. I think it's more of just like something that I want to work on because it keeps happening.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think then the thing that's really powerful and interesting is what you keep saying in terms of when the design of the game suggests and leads the player to a different yes. a play style that is so definitively this character or this tone that you are in my mind it's like I've been set up to surprise myself. Like I could imagine, you know, it's like when you're playing Doom, you ripping things apart with your bare hands with a savagery that you wouldn't just have normally.
Yeah.
Are you surprised by that? Do you enjoy that? Do you feel it?
The game invites you to be that person, yes. even if you wouldn't yourself bring yes. it to an open system.
Right, right, yeah.
And I do feel very strongly that games should be doing that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Players should have agency to bring themselves to an experience,
mm-hmm.
but the experience should it feels contradictory, but it's really not. It's mm-hmm. like there should be a lot of authorial intent in games that invite role play, and the interesting sizzle of it is what individual players bring to that context,
mm-hmm.
but a fully open whatever requires so much more, and it does. It's very death of the author, mm-hmm. which is fine, right? If that's a system you want to build, but if your game has a setting and a world, and then you ask the player to like, all right, make your character. We have 7,000 options. You can do 800 different things.
Yeah.
Then like it puts so much on the player to get the experience that you're designing for them.
Right.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah. 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 I think actually, Joanna, to answer your question earlier that you asked, are all video games role playing? I think they're not all role playing, but maybe they should be, or maybe they could be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting.
They could be insofar that they literally could be. Any yes. game could be.
Well, yeah.
But
I mean, like maybe
not puzzle games, not like Tetris.
Well, like Tetris. Yeah. Yeah. You're not really role playing Tetris. I guess you could, but like anyway.
The abstract strategy. Genre does present problems with as little theming as possible, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like there's a little bit of the Soviet laborer who just everything keeps crumbling around yeah. you. The work never ends. You never make progress and build something because it just keeps falling down on you. It gets harder and harder until you eventually die.
Sure.
I'm now convinced I have no imagination. All right.
Now that is an American invention from the publishers of the various versions of Tetris.
Okay.
The Soviet designer who created Tetris was not out to
that's fair.
To emulate the experience of working
at
a government
did it
lab.
Accidentally.
Yeah, yeah. Right, 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 right.
If you haven't.
Yeah, just the upbringing created for it.
If you haven't seen this gem of the internet, look up the history of the Soviet Union to the tune of Tetris.
I did watch the movie that Apple TV put out
yeah.
about it. That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fun is the right word for it. It's not much more than that.
It was very fun.
Yeah.
Anyway. It could
There's
be.
There's a car chase in that movie.
But it could be
there
role playing.
There is
power
for that to yeah, be yeah. there.
We don't need a universal framework necessarily.
Yeah.
But sometimes, I think as a podcast, we do tend to lean towards universal framework.
I mean,
but
yeah,
we don't need one necessarily.
Role play and embodied game mechanics can shake hands, I think.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. That is a good way of framing it. Cool. Oh, yeah.
All your questions answered now?
Oh, of course. They're always answered by the end of this episode. Yeah.
Good. Now you have more time to work on your prototypes.
Yeah. So I want to thank listeners. I have actually been told that I've been wrong. On our feedback form.
Right.
Go to nicegames.club.
For folks who don't know what he's talking about,
yeah.
Steven's just been begging.
Begging.
For, you know, community ombudsman
mm-hmm.
to just tell you you're wrong.
Just lay it on me.
Yeah.
And what I've been told is that I don't have enough hot takes on the show.
Yeah. That is solid feedback.
Yeah. So to improve that, one hot take I think I can bring back again is I don't like achievements. I think achievements are terrible and need to be removed. So if you don't like that, go to nicegames.club/feedback. Let me know why achievements are great, I guess.
What I love about this is that folks who skip this middle part of the show, because they're like, they're not as funny as they think they are.
How dare they?
I know. Yeah. They're going to miss this hot take.
Mm-hmm.
Let Steven know what you think. Mm-hmm. Nicegames.club/feedback.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
I struggle most weeks to like get up, get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because like, I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.
Okay, so second half of the show, I have a topic which we put together last minute. It's really Joanna's topic. You walked in today saying, I'm doing a lot. I don't know. What do I want to talk about? And we kind of hammered out an idea, which is we talked about what you're working on lately, which is this input library that you're doing for Chickensoft, which is people don't know, they can listen back to the last episode we had you on to hear more about Chickensoft. But you're working on this input library, and you've had to rewrite it a couple of times.
Yep. Input's hard enough, as everybody knows who's ever done input remapping.
Truly.
And it's just like, that's like one of those things you put on your game as polish, but if you didn't kind of think it through early on, or your engine doesn't make it super easy for you, and I don't think they ever do, then it's just like a bunch of suffering. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I can solve it once in a way that'll work for most people using Godot and C#. And in the process of doing that, I've been kind of poking at this library off and on for about a year because it's kind of a monster. And then I'm also waiting on Godot itself.
We got there.
You got me. But I am waiting on it because they're in the process of bringing in the SDL3 library, which is solves a lot of the input hardware problems. Mm-hmm. It's another open source project that's, you know, really well done. And so they're working on that, which will improve a lot of things, open up some new APIs, which will help, you know, just little things like being able to know what kind of console was a controller designed for. And like, you just cannot do that in Godot today until these changes go through. But then, you know, every, like even the generic, you know, controllers, they have a purpose. Like they're like, yeah, I'm in the style of an Xbox.
Right.
Mm. Or in the style of a PlayStation. Because that's what they're compatible with. And so like you need to know that if you want to show icons on screen of like press this button and you want it to be from the right controller group.
Yep.
And so that's like a huge problem. And input prompts is like a huge problem. And so that's another thing you can make easier for people. And you can also make that easier in the context of remapping where you show what your, you know, people have punched in and stuff. So it's a huge project. And it's something I've poked at off and on for like a year now. And then, you know, in the process of managing like button presses and things like that, I was like, well, it would be nice to have a state machine so I can just handle, you know, long press holding and different behaviors and stuff like that. And the state machine library I have is great. People seem to like it. And I enjoy it. But
this is the more genericized state machine that you've built, right?
Yeah, it's called Logic Blocks, but it's really just a hierarchical state machine or state chart in math. Or not quite, but it's like almost one. It's a little bit simpler. And so, you know, I enjoyed that, but it has dependencies on some source generation and some other like developer tooling stuff that just kind of gets in the way when you're putting it inside of a library.
Yeah.
It's fine in your game project because your game project is the end of the pipeline. But then if you introduce all of that as a dependency to something else, and it kind of conflicts with everything. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you can cause people problems when they try to add that to their library and they're using a different version of the thing that this thing also uses. And that just creates like suffering. Yeah. And so I was like, well, I really need to clean up the state machine library and like get it simpler. And so then so on down that. And then I was working on that. I was like, oh, I can generalize the bindings and so on. And so now I'm like four projects deep, you know. This isn't uncommon. I've been here before many times. And so that's kind of where I ended up.
Yeah, yeah. And as someone who also gets down that rabbit hole, sometimes I have to step back and like, is this just my way of working, or is this what this project actually needs?
Yeah.
Sometimes I worry about that. Is that something that you struggle with as well?
Well, you know, it's a depth first strategy in terms of like tree walking, right? You just keep doing the thing that needs to be done immediately.
Yeah. So, okay. So ultimately, the question we're presenting.
Right. The title of this topic is a little bit cheeky, but we're really just talking about like refactoring, re-architecting, iterating.
Yeah.
Iterating, I think maybe the key is like, you know, when is it important? When is it, you know, when is it creating tech debt versus cleaning up
tech
debt?
Well, we're not specifically talking about iterating. We're talking about rebuilding old things that need, that are old and could be improved. But, well, I guess or that's what iteration is.
I was like, I should really correct him as he's talking. I'm like, no, he'll get there.
Yeah.
So, I guess for me, the iterating versus rebuilding, it's like, is the iteration big enough or frequent enough or in enough places that it actually is going to be better for the project, your sanity, whatever, to take that knowledge that you had learned from where you are right now, open a new project and just rebuild it clean from your very, very messy notes first draft. That's kind of the question of, and I just for any project, you know, do you just open up a blank slate with the knowledge that you had come before from the messiness? Is it worth it to continue doing those edits, those revisions, those refactorings in the same project?
Right. When is it time to just like rebuild it versus
start from scratch almost,
put a new coat of paint or whatever.
So
maybe let's go around the table then and maybe talk about either examples of one or the other sort of decision points perhaps, and this doesn't have to be code necessarily.
This
applies elsewhere.
It does. It literally start with this. Oh, actually that's a good point. Okay, so because I realize
it's getting lined up, folks.
The previous episode, I talked about how I've been making a custom spirit for Spirit Island.
Yes.
And it's been a year and a half or something. And I've redone it like three or four times now.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep coming back to it because I'm like, I'm trying to make this still feel characteristic and interesting. And actually, I guess it's a little bit of the role play aspect of it, too. Like, I'm trying to figure out how you can design a thing so that the player feels like they can embody or role play that character without actually doing it, without having to actively role play. And so like I keep throwing out things and starting from scratch with this thing because I feel like previous iterations didn't do what I was hoping for from the design. And I think that like the reason I keep coming, it's interesting because like I keep doing that, but like a lot of stuff that like I will come back to previous design decisions from a new perspective and like do almost the same thing in a way that like is weird.
Right. Cause there's definitely if you're in that situation, you can find yourself making it different because you're bored.
Yeah.
Or it's like you want to feel like you're making progress. So you don't want to do the same thing again.
Yes.
And then you're just making change for change's sake.
Yes.
Right. And you're not doing that.
No, that's what I'm saying. I am restarting and I am intentionally trying to do something new, but I also end up doing a lot of the stuff that I was doing before.
Yeah.
I'm like sort of, reinventing the wheel. That's the word. I'm like sort of reinventing the wheel intentionally. Like I got to understand why I made these decisions in the past. And sometimes those decisions actually did make sense, but I have to like do it again to know why they made sense.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of why I've been doing it this way. And so like I think that's an example of a reason why I would do it. Now, oftentimes, especially when I'm coding, I hate rebuilding crap
because
it's the worst. Because I'm like, I already did it. I don't want to do it again. I'll just add a few different things. It'll make it a little bit better. But sometimes you do need to do it because like the code is so fragile. If you make any tweaks, the whole game crashes.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's when I will rebuild something, but I will try as best as I can not to do it because it's slower.
Right.
A lot of the time.
You kind of brought up a really interesting point of like, oh, you're working on something. You're like, oh, yeah, I can change this thing I already did, make it better. And then you go to do it and you're like, oh, I forgot that's why I did it this way.
Yeah.
Like that happens to me all the time.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That's constant for me, too.
Yeah, yeah. You're taking notes?
Are you going to tell me to comment my code now, Mark?
I mean, you know, I think it's self-evident.
Okay.
See, the thing is, I do comment my code.
Yeah.
And then I change the code that the comment goes with. So I delete the comment.
Right.
Oh.
And I don't add another one.
Yeah, that's what I do, too. Yes.
No, I will definitely, when I get into that thing of like rebuilding something, I will, I'm pretty good about making sure I'm documenting as I go. I feel like that's a good habit I have.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm good at it, but I'm pretty pleased because it does create problems. Because I will, you know, you still, no one's perfect. You still encounter places where you're like, what even is this? And then you walk through it step by step, you delete it and then try to know what it's for. So you start rebuilding it. And then that's the only way to learn why you did it, essentially, is to rebuild it.
Yeah, yeah.
I have been in those situations. Mm-hmm. I have two examples for the broader examples section, which is Noble Engine, which is my little game engine for Playdate, did start out as just, you know, tools and stuff I needed for a game that I was making, which never got made. Mm-hmm. And then that just, it got more and more genericized, and then the context changed. Then I wanted to make it a library for other people.
Yeah.
So, like, that kind of, it's not an uncommon story. Many people have ended with a game engine, started with a game. But it's, so it's cliche almost, but it just runs away from you. But then when that changes, suddenly you have this, like, new focus and purpose. And that was very helpful to what it would do and what it couldn't do, right? Mm-hmm. That actually helped me then when I was doing more prototypes. So that was kind of an interesting experience with that. And then the other example, which is totally the opposite for me, is I'm rebuilding the Noble Robot website right now because I wanted to update a lot of the content management backend.
Yeah.
And I'm changing to a different hosting provider, and I updated the visual design. And I don't want to change much about it. Like, I want all the same types of information to be on the pages. I want it to be structured very similarly. I don't really want to change the homepage that much in terms of, like, user flow and UX.
Yeah.
But I am changing the visual design. And so I just decided to just completely rebuild it from scratch rather than try to work within the existing thing. Because I'm like, I don't even know what this CSS was that I wrote 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, I know what it looks like. I can do this pretty quickly. And it's not something I do day to day. Web development is not a day to day thing for me. It would just be faster for me to start over.
Yeah.
Than try to like hammer something that's already been hammered, you know, sort of into a different shape.
So I know you're a big CSS fan.
I love CSS.
But you're already proving my counterpoint that I've made to you previously, which is like CSS is garbage. It's disposable.
Well, okay. I didn't get into it, but I used a Bootstrap. Originally, that's a framework for designing sites for column layouts and stuff like that. And it comes with all this CSS to basically make it so that the developer has to write less CSS of their own. But I like CSS, so like I don't want to like add classes to markup and like that be the way I design things. Mm. So what I ended up with was just all this Bootstrap code and then all of mine on top of it, and it was a little sloppy. So one of the reasons I'm rebuilding it is to just not use a framework, like a style library, and just, I know how it works. I don't need the helper tool anymore. I thought I did because I don't have a lot of web dev experience. So I thought, like, I should do this. And then I realized, oh, actually, I have the knowledge I need that I actually don't need this tool. But I only learned that after I finished making it, and it was all a big
mess. Right, okay.
But there's a reason they've moved to the slap a class on it frameworks like Tailwind.
Because we are definitely going to have this fight in the parking lot later. But like...
I'll have it now.
Yeah.
Maybe not on air.
Tickets $5.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's definitely a case of like making it easier for people who are not visual designers to do visual design.
Sure. Yeah.
If you are a visual designer, it becomes very, they're actually handcuffs.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you're that good.
Lydia, when have you rebuilt something?
I have an example, I guess, only really from crafting, but hopefully something to add. So you've already talked about rebuilding because you didn't necessarily remember why you did something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a problem,
right,
or it became a problem. One of the things that I find with crafting, especially when it comes to something like knitting, is if I'm going through a pattern and I've made a decision that isn't ideal, but I made it at the time to be able to move forward, or I made a mistake and then I, you know, adjusted for it in the moment. There is a point where I can get to a point where it's like, okay, I've made enough decisions and I'm not happy with this. I don't know how far back I need to go in order to correct the things.
Yeah.
Right, right.
So it's one of those, and then it's also the sunk cost fallacy of, am I okay with the mistakes that I've made that I can tell are there enough, or decision, not even mistakes, but the decisions that I've made that I'm not fully happy with?
Yeah.
Am I okay with it enough to keep going, or has it compounded to the point where if I finish this, I will be unhappy with it? And at that point, especially for me, when it comes to knitting, it's a lot harder for me to pull out and then not overshoot by accident, just because of how the yarn works. Also, sometimes depending on the yarn, if you knit with it, it can a lot and like start and stop, or like knit something, pull it out, knit something, pull it out. It ends up wearing on the thread, on the yarn, in a way that is gross and makes it harder to work with.
Yeah.
There can be a point where it's like, all right, this isn't working and I don't know how to go back far. I don't know how to go back and correct the point where it started falling apart metaphorically. I'm going to start fresh because I need to, like, I can't recognize where to go back to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's funny about that description is it is technical, but it's also conceptual.
Mm-hmm.
And I can imagine programmers and like Photoshop compositors in the audience are all nodding along.
Yeah.
Because you're describing a very similar process.
Yeah.
In a technical sense to like when you do have to like unwind things in a code base, or in, you know, or in an art project or something like that, a digital art project. So it is, yeah, some of these things can be universally applied.
Yeah. I think that fundamentally, we talked in the micro studio, I mentioned that I realized I can't genericize the code right away, but I have to build it and then I need to go back, build the thing hard code, and then I have to go back and genericize it.
Yeah.
Very similar reasoning, or a very similar sense of being lost in the sauce, as I feel when I know that something's gone wrong, I've tried to address it and it's not working and I don't know how to go back and fix it. It's very similar feeling, and I think it's because it's ambiguous decisions on top of ambiguous deceptions that might have been on top of a mistake. And it is also sometimes hard to tell what was a bad decision versus one you just made.
Yeah.
Right.
Versus
I've never felt so
error.
Understood in my life.
Aww.
Nothing captures like programming, apparently, like knitting. I had no idea they were the same.
Yeah. I mean, I think crafting in general, it is very much like that. One of the things that I keep thinking just hearing all of this is something that I've heard from a cosplayer who I really like, and that I've been trying to embody with my own work in anything, is the slow way is the fast way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That idea being like, if you stop and do it and slow down and do it properly the first time, you save yourself a ton of time and heartache trying to correct things later on and trying to keep nudging things over. You know, that idea of like 16ths of an inch, if there's enough of them, leads up to a full few inches.
Yeah.
That idea.
Well, there's a corollary to that, which is in the example you were describing, which is the and in the micro studio example, which is that you do sort of need to go down the rough path a little while before you know what the paved path should look like.
Yes.
And so I think when you're trying to optimize or do it right the first time, it can be very easy to fall into the trap of pre-optimizing, or being like, I want to design it completely first before I start building it at all.
Yep.
And that can be kind of difficult, but the opposite is also just as dangerous. So it is really, and it's very contextual.
Yeah.
Depends on what kind of project it is. But there is, as you'll write something, then you'll delete it all and rewrite it better. And you'll kind of feel like, all right, that wasn't super efficient, but I got it done. But actually, that is the fastest way to do it, right?
Yeah.
And that's sort of another way to just say the slow way is the fast way.
Yeah.
But like, so there's multiple approaches to that you know, expressing that idiom, I suppose.
Yeah.
But like, I don't want people to walk away thinking like, oh, I should make sure to, you know, to not move fast and break things ever, because sometimes, and again, it's personal style as well. You just, as long as you unwind and get there in the end, you know.
Yeah. And I think there is a sense of how much are you willing to deal with,
yeah,
and in a given moment. I think because one of the things is when looking back on the path that is unpaved, if you realize, oh, in order, kind of like with your fragile code, if the act of having to debug what's broken every time you change something in the process of making it a little bit more of a solid feature is slowing it down and making it really hard for you to make good decisions in your iteration process, and because if you're setting yourself up to make bad decisions trying to fix things as you're trying to make good decisions, that I think is a situation which, to me at least, I would go, okay, clean slate, let's take what our notes and go forward. But, you know, there's a difference between that and, all right, I roughly know what I need to do, and I know that there's going to be some quirks and some things I need to figure out. I mentally know enough of, or I am able to handle that, or they're going to come up at the end and I can, in a way that I can just spend a day debugging once I get this started. I think that also just state of mind for and state of understanding the problem and understanding what could potentially fall out from fixing it or rebuilding it or iterating further on the thing,
yeah,
is another deciding factor.
Yeah.
Because like, it could just be that it's like, oh yeah, this art style we picked does mean that we have these problems. It's just built into the process of iterate on the thing, okay, expect that these problems might happen, then go back and see it and untangle the messes.
Right.
So what happens when I'm knitting and like, mm-hmm, maybe it's like more advanced than a scarf.
Okay.
I don't know. What would be more advanced than a scarf?
A hat?
Anything with shaping that's not a rectangle. Let's say a raglan sweater. That's like the most basic sweater thing.
Okay. So it's not super complicated. So what happens if I miss some stitches or something or whatever it's called?
Mm-hmm.
Make a mistake, but I don't go back and unwind it. I just keep going.
So, I mean, it depends on the mistake. You will end, usually what happens is if you don't realize it, you will hit a point in the instructions and go, wait a second, this is not matching up. It's very much like IKEA furniture where you're like, oh, that's wait a second. I'm supposed to have 6 screws. I have 7. Mm-hmm. Something happened.
Incidentally, I did that the other day when building furniture.
Yeah, it's very similar. So usually, because oftentimes when you have instructions, it's like, okay, at this point, you should have this many stitches, or you need to do this many you need to knit these many stitches and then do this other thing. And then you realize, oh, wait a second, it said knit 4 and then slip 2, but I have 3. Where did that third stitch come from?
Yeah.
And the answer of that answer could be a number of things that you didn't notice. And it
could I keep going anyway?
You could make it into two, like essentially combine 2 stitches together to make that. But
so you can like duct tape it.
Yeah, you can duct tape
it. The metaphor on this is like too good, because that's very true with code as well. Right?
But like, the thing is that like, depending on when and how and where you duct tape it, it could change the shape of the thing.
Oh yeah,
and cause what you problems.
Might need is a patch.
Yes.
So the reason I'm asking is it's a perfect metaphor for all this other stuff.
Yeah.
So we might as well just keep talking about knitting.
Yeah.
Because it just works. So,
yeah.
Knitting games club.
If I just power through and I'm like, oh, I only made 2 or 3 small mistakes. Sure, they're compounding. And I finish the sweater. Yep. What's the sweater going to be like?
It could depend.
Suboptimal. But you know what? That's okay.
Sometimes, I didn't realize you knit too.
Sometimes it's fine because it was... like where you put the patch is, it's not in an obvious spot sometimes, like where you, and so it's like, oh, it's in the armpit, no one's gonna look up my armpit unless they're weird like that, and they're not gonna notice this mistake. Or sometimes it's going to be like, oh, okay, I caught it soon enough, close to where it needed to be, that number of stitches, so it looks natural, right? But sometimes it's like, oh, I had my yarn broke and I had to fasten it and then tied it off and it ended up being right in the middle of my boobs where the knot is. So it looks like I have a knot nipple. and then you're like, okay, well, maybe I wear this sweater backwards. And then you're like, but it doesn't fit properly backwards because it was shaped to fit front and have a front and a back that was clear. And then you don't wear the sweater that you made.
I feel like the metaphor maybe escaped from...
is all still working.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's sometimes you don't know where the mistake is going to land and be obvious in the finished product.
Right.
And sometimes until too late, or sometimes you realize, oh, this is like right in the front of the project, but you make the decision to keep going because of sunk cost fallacy. And then you look back and you go, oh, that's ugly.
It's not a bug, it's obvious. A
feature. You're a prophet.
And then sometimes you look at that result and you're like, okay, you know what? I made some mistakes. It's I'm gonna start over.
Yeah.
Right?
And then sometimes
version two.
Yeah. Or you make it a feature and you're like, okay, this knot in a very obvious place, I'm gonna add a couple more so it looks like it's on purpose.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, fascinating.
You know, it's really interesting because it's like there's like this anecdotal thing that people quote a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's actual data behind this, but the story is that some professor had two groups of pottery students or whatever. You probably heard this. Told mm-hmm. one of them to make the best stuff and told the other to make as many stuff as possible. And the people that practiced a lot ended up doing better.
Yeah.
That this is college kids, though. This is not peer-reviewed blind study that's been verified.
Right.
But like you get the idea, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a philosophy more than it is an anecdote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there is an element of like you do have to see enough stuff through,
mm-hmm.
mistakes and all.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes you may not actually finish it if you corrected every mistake.
Yes.
Because you need experience under your belt.
Yeah.
You need to know what a finished thing looks like, even if it's a hack job.
Yeah.
And so there's that. And then at the same time, as you get better, you can reduce the likelihood of making mistakes, but you should still finish things.
Yeah, I think some of it also, and maybe this is more emotional as opposed to logistical, there is a reckoning that you have when you look at the project you're working on that you thought was going to be the final project file, like the main project file, and go, at this point, it would be better if I consider this a prototype.
Yeah.
Having to look at like what you thought was going to be your best effort, like your main one, and you went through that learning process and go, oh, this is not the final product. This is a practice one. It's a little hard sometimes to kind of look at yourself and look at the thing you made and realize that it's not its purpose is not what you had intended it to be.
Yeah. And I think when you're in a vacuum and it's just your machine, your project, your timeline, you're the producer. I think that then you have lots of choices to make then, right? Like,
yes.
is this the version I go with because I put in the time and it's not exactly what I want, but like I can move on to another project, or do I think I have another version in me that can make this better? Or should I, you know, whatever. There's lots of different versions of that. But I think I want to end this topic on the idea that like there is that we don't live in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think I'm just thinking about this a lot with Blippo, which I just finished September 23rd.
Let's go.
Switching PC. That there's lots of systems in there that are really sloppy.
Sure. Yeah.
Because there was a lot of there was some crunch on the project at the end that I was not happy about.
Yeah.
But a lot of what that meant was that I had to make a feature or a system that I had to sort of let everybody know, so communication is key as well, that I'll do this, but just so you know, we can't change it.
Yeah.
Because I'm not building it right. I'm building it so that it works and it'll be great and the player won't notice and it will be a great product, but like it's not maintainable.
Yeah.
So FYI, if we want to make a tweak to it later, we're going to have to rebuild it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I had to make sure that the rest of the team and the production team knew, but also that they were complicit in the choice of.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I did my best to make sure that was key, but ultimately that ended up in a final product that I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
But sometimes I go into that code base and I'm like really kind of embarrassed for myself.
Sure.
I'm like, I'm glad I'm the only one working on it.
Yeah.
But that is a totally different angle on this, right? You have this outside the vacuum context to these sorts of things.
Yeah.
There were lots of systems in that game that I did rebuild and iterate on.
Yeah.
That I'm glad I did. And the question was, did I do that? Could I have been a little sloppier so I could have more time for features that came later? And there was no way for me to know the time.
So yeah.
It's all just rolling down a hill. You don't really know what path you're going or how long the hill is.
Mm-hmm.
But I think everything we've talked about is really important to think about in sort of an idealistic sense. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it's, you should always aim for that kind of a deliberate thing, but also, and this is where practice comes. Sometimes it takes practice to know when to do the sloppy, low effort version.
Does it
right?
also influence how you go about with your versioning of branches and stuff? So in terms of like, as you get practice or as you start going through this process, does that question of will this be something I want to, should, maybe will have to rebuild also influence like, do I make a new branch for this? Do I merge this to the project in general? Do I do this in a separate thing on the side?
Right. The sort of standard, like, let's build a feature in isolation. Now, on Blippo, I was the only developer. So I pretty much, my Git tree is a trunk, right? For the most part. I didn't have to worry about work because no one else was, branches are great for when there's worry of conflict. Mm. So this is another bit of like thing is like a lot of times people who are working by themselves will have really complicated Git trees.
Yeah.
And it's just they're spending a lot of time. You know, on that necessarily, you know, do what works for you.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes you can make it simpler. You don't have to do it, quote unquote, the right way.
Yeah.
Anyways, but in the case of things where, like, I know that one day if we wanted to do this right in, like, a bigger update, it would need to be unwound in a pretty serious way. That is where I am. I will take the extra time, no matter how much crunch I'm under, to write good comments. Mm. Because, lots of notes. I will spend more time on notes than on the code because, like, the code I can do quickly. To do it right would take 10 times longer, but to do it, you know, just good enough, I can do. But I need to make sure I'm documenting this because it's not my normal process.
Right.
My normal programmer brain will look back at that and not understand how it was made.
Yeah.
It's not done the way I normally do things.
Right, right.
And so I won't compromise on that kind of thing. I will, if I'm asked for two things, I will say no to one of those things, even if I have to do the first one sloppily, so I can leave the breadcrumbs for myself.
Yeah.
That's pretty key. Now, how much of that you need for yourself is really up to you to decide.
I do think that a comment or any form of note to self, like, or note to others where this is probably bad, but I had to make a decision, so I made a decision.
Yeah.
Is also really helpful because I think one of the things that can happen when you forget is you can ascribe meaning to something that was arbitrary.
Yeah.
And that complicates then the process of how do you fix something. And knowing that something was arbitrary, first draft, just had to do it in order to do another thing, then infinitely helps in terms of untangling messes in the future.
Those are absolutely the things I will comment.
Yeah. Well, this is a real everything is everything moment because one of the things that I talk a lot about in game design is like sometimes you're telling players things you don't realize you're telling them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you just described the exact same process of a programmer telling their future self. Like something they didn't, some meaning that wasn't actually ascribed.
Right. We'll
interpret it and think, oh, that's why I did that. I shouldn't touch it. When actually you just did it for some random reason, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So all of that is, yeah.
It's like when someone picks up the sweater and it's like, oh, well, there's a bunch of knots. So I guess I'll keep adding knots.
Yeah.
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 Right? I was still thinking about sweaters, but I guess we could talk about code and stuff.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes, delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode, or others, or whatever. Tell Steven he's wrong, and your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, Joanna will be back for a Nice Games Jam. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
I struggle most weeks to like get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because like, I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.